This is disc number 3.
Alaska remarked, "So I heard Takumi told you. Yeah, I ratted out Mariah, and I'm sorry, and I'll never do it again. In other news, are you staying here for Thanksgiving? Because I am." I rolled back toward the wall and pulled the comforter over my head. I didn't know whether to trust Alaska, and I'd certainly had enough of her unpredictability. Cold one day, sweet the next. Irresistibly flirty one moment, resistibly obnoxious the next. I preferred the Colonel. At least when he was cranky, he had a reason. In a testament to the power of fatigue, I managed to fall asleep quickly, convinced that the shrieking of dying monsters and Alaska's delighted squeals upon killing them were nothing more than a pleasant soundtrack by which to dream. I woke up half an hour later when she sat down on my bed, her butt against my hip. Her underwear, her jeans, the comforter, my corduroys, and my boxers between us, I thought. 5 layers. And yet I felt it, the nervous warmth of touching, a pale reflection of the fireworks of one mouth on another, but a reflection nonetheless. And in the almostness of the moment, I cared at least enough. I wasn't sure whether I liked her, and I doubted whether I could trust her, but I cared at least enough to try to find out. Her on my bed, wide green eyes staring down at me, the enduring mystery of her sly, almost smirking smile. 5 layers between us. She continued as if I hadn't been asleep. "Jake has to study, so he doesn't want me in Nashville. Says he can't pay attention to musicology while staring at me. I said I would wear a burqa, but he wasn't convinced, so I'm staying here." "I'm sorry," I said. "Oh, don't be. I'll have loads to do. There's a prank to plan. But I was thinking you should stay here, too. In fact, I have composed a list." "A list?" She reached into her pocket and pulled out a heavily folded piece of notebook paper and began to read.
"Why Pudge Should Stay at the Creek for Thanksgiving, a list by Alaska Young. 1. Because he is a very conscientious student. Pudge has been deprived of many wonderful Culver Creek experiences, including but not limited to A. drinking wine with me in the woods, and B. getting up early on a Saturday to eat breakfast at McInedible, and then driving through the Greater Birmingham area, smoking cigarettes, and talking about how pathetically boring the Greater Birmingham area is, and also C. going out late at night and lying in the dewy soccer field and reading a Kurt Vonnegut book by moonlight. 2. Although she certainly does not excel at endeavors such as teaching the French language, Madame O'Malley makes a mean stuffing, and she invites all the students who stay on campus to Thanksgiving dinner, which is usually just me and the South Korean exchange student, but whatever, Pudge would be welcome. 3. I don't really have a 3, but 1 and 2 were awfully good.
1 and 2 appealed to me, certainly, but mostly I liked the idea of just her and just me on campus.
"I'll talk to my parents once they wake up," I said.
She coaxed me onto the couch, and we played decapitation together until she abruptly dropped the controller.
"I'm not flirting, I'm just tired," she said, kicking off her flip-flops.
She pulled her feet onto the foam couch, tucking them behind a cushion, and scooted up to put her head in my lap. My corduroys, my boxers. 2 layers. I could feel the warmth of her cheek on my thigh.
There are times when it's appropriate, even preferable, to get an erection when someone's face is in close proximity to your penis. This was not one of those times. So I stopped thinking about the layers and the warmth, muted the TV, and focused on decapitation. At 8:30, I turned off the game and scooted out from underneath Alaska.
She turned onto her back, still asleep, the lines of my corduroy pants imprinted on her cheek. I usually only called my parents on Sunday afternoons, so when my mom heard my voice, she instantly overreacted.
"What's wrong, Miles? Are you okay?"
"I'm fine, Mom. I think, if it's okay with you, I think I might stay here for Thanksgiving. A lot of my friends are staying, lie, and I have a lot of work to do, double lie. I had no idea how hard the classes would be, Mom, truth."
"Oh, sweetie, we miss you so much, and there's a big Thanksgiving turkey waiting for you, and all the cranberry sauce you can eat."
I hated cranberry sauce,
but for some reason my mom persisted in her lifelong belief that it was my very favorite food, even though every single Thanksgiving I politely declined to include it on my plate. "I know, Mom, I miss you guys too, but I really want to do well here, Truth. And plus, it's really nice to have, like, friends, Truth." I knew that playing the friend card would sell her on the idea, and it did. So I got her blessing to stay on campus after promising to hang out with them for every minute of Christmas break, as if I had other plans. I spent the morning at the computer, flipping back and forth between my religion and English papers. There were only 2 weeks of classes before exams, the coming one and the one after Thanksgiving, and so far the best personal answer I had to what happens to people after they die was, well, something. Maybe. The colonel came in at noon, his thick uber-math book cradled in his arms. "I just saw Sarah," he said. "How'd that work out for you?" "Bad. She said she still loved me." "God, I love you really is the gateway drug of breaking up. Saying I love you while you're walking across the dorm circle inevitably leads to saying I love you while you're doing it, so I just bolted." I laughed. He pulled out a notebook and sat down at his desk. "Yeah, ha ha. So Alaska says you're staying here." "Yeah, I feel a little guilty about ditching my parents, though." "Yeah, well, if you're staying here in hopes of making out with Alaska, I sure wish you wouldn't. If you unmoor her from the rock that is Jake, God have mercy on us all. That would be some drama indeed, and as a rule, I like to avoid drama." "It's not because I want to make out with her." "Hold on." He grabbed a pencil and scrawled excitedly at the paper, as if he'd just made a mathematical breakthrough, and then looked back up at me. "I just did some calculations, and I've been able to determine that you're full of shit." And he was right. How could I abandon my parents, who were nice enough to pay for my education at Culver Creek? My parents who had always loved me, just because I maybe liked some girl with a boyfriend? How could I leave them alone with a giant turkey and mounds of inedible cranberry sauce? So, during third period, I called my mom at work. I wanted her to say it was okay, I guess, for me to stay at the creek for Thanksgiving, but I didn't quite expect her to excitedly tell me that she and Dad had bought plane tickets to England immediately after I called and were planning to spend Thanksgiving in a castle on their second honeymoon. "Oh, that's awesome," I said, and then quickly got off the phone because I did not want her to hear me cry. I guess Alaska heard me slam down the phone from her room because she opened the door as I turned away but said nothing. I walked across the dorm circle and then straight through the soccer fields, bushwhacking through the woods, until I ended up on the banks of Culver Creek, just down from the bridge. I sat with my butt on a rock and my feet in the dark dirt of the creek bed and tossed pebbles into the clear, shallow water, and they landed with an empty plop, barely audible over the rumbling of the creek as it danced its way south. The light filtered through the leaves and pine needles above as if through lace, the ground spotted in shadow. I thought of the one thing about home that I missed, my dad's study, with its built-in floor-to-ceiling shelves sagging with thick biographies, and the black leather chair that kept me just uncomfortable enough to keep from falling asleep as I read. It was stupid to feel as upset as I did. I ditched them, but it felt the other way around. Still, I felt unmistakably homesick. I looked up toward the bridge and saw Alaska sitting on one of the blue chairs at the smoking hole, and though I'd thought I wanted to be alone, I found myself saying, "Hey." Then, when she did not turn to me, I screamed, "Alaska!" She walked over. "I was looking for you," she said, joining me on the rock. "Hey, I'm really sorry, Pudge," she said, and put her arms around me, resting her head against my shoulder. It occurred to me that she didn't even know what had happened, but she still sounded sincere. "What am I going to do?" "You'll spend Thanksgiving with me, silly, here." "So why don't you go home for vacations?" I asked. "I'm just scared of ghosts, Pudge, and home is full of them." 52 days before. After everyone left, After the colonel's mom showed up in a beat-up hatchback and he threw his giant duffel bag into the back seat, and after he said, "I'm not much for saying goodbye. I'll see you in a week. Don't do anything I wouldn't do." And after a green limousine arrived for Lara, whose father was the only doctor in some small town in southern Alabama, and after I joined Alaska on a harrowing we-don't-need-no-stinking-breaks drive to the airport to drop off Takumi, and after the campus settled into an eerie quiet with no doors slamming and no music playing and no one laughing and no one screaming, after all that, we made our way down to the soccer field, and she took me to the edge of the field where the woods start, the same steps I'd walked on my way to being thrown into the lake. Beneath the full moon, she cast a shadow, and you could see the curve from her waist to her hips in the shadow, and after a while, she stopped and said, "Dig." And I said, "Dig?" And she said, "Dig." And we went on like that for a bit, and then I got on my knees and dug through the soft black dirt at the edge of the woods, and before I could get very far, my fingers scratched glass, and I dug around the glass until I pulled out a bottle of pink wine. Strawberry Hill, it was called, I suppose because if it had not tasted like vinegar with a dash of maple syrup, it might have tasted like strawberries. "I have a fake ID," she said, "but it sucks. So every time I go to the liquor store, I try to buy 10 bottles of this and some vodka for the colonel. And so when it finally works, I'm covered for a semester. And then I give the colonel his vodka, and he puts it wherever he puts it, and I take mine and bury it." "Because you're a pirate," I said. "Aye, matey. Precisely. Although wine consumption has risen a bit this semester, so we'll need to take a trip tomorrow. This is the last bottle." She unscrewed the cap, no corks here, sipped, and handed it to me. "Don't worry about the eagle tonight," she said. "He's just happy most everyone's gone. He's probably masturbating for the first time in a month." I worried about it for a moment as I held the bottle by the neck, but I wanted to trust her, and so I did. I took a minor sip, and as soon as I swallowed, I felt my body rejecting the stinging syrup of it. It washed back up my esophagus, but I swallowed hard, and there, yes, I did it. I was drinking on campus. So we lay in the tall grass between the soccer field and the woods, passing the bottle back and forth and tilting our heads up to sip the wince-inducing wine. As promised in the list, she brought a Kurt Vonnegut book, Cat's Cradle, and she read aloud to me, her soft voice mingling with the frogs croaking and the grasshoppers landing softly around us. I did not hear her words so much as the cadence of her voice. She'd obviously read the book many times before, and so she read flawlessly and confidently, and I could hear her smile in the reading of it. And the sound of that smile made me think that maybe I would like novels better if Alaska Young read them to me. After a while, she put down the book, and I felt warm but not drunk with the bottle resting between us, my chest touching the bottle and her chest touching the bottle, but us not touching each other. And then she placed her hand on my leg. Her hand just above my knee, the palm flat and soft against my jeans, and her index finger making slow, lazy circles that crept toward the inside of my thigh. And with one layer between us, God, I wanted her. And lying there amid the tall, still grass and beneath the star-drunk sky, listening to the just this side of inaudible sound of her rhythmic breathing and the noisy silence of the bullfrogs, the grasshoppers, the distant cars rushing endlessly on I-65, I thought it might be a fine time to say the three little words. And I steeled myself to say them as I stared up at that starriest night, convinced myself that she felt it too, that her hand, so alive and vivid against my leg, was more than playful. And fuck Lara and fuck Jake, because I do, Alaska Young, I do love you, and what else matters but that? And my lips parted to speak, and before I could even begin to breathe out the words, she said, "It's not life or death, the labyrinth."
Okay, so what is it?
"Suffering," she said. "Doing wrong and having wrong things happen to you. That's the problem. Bolivar was talking about the pain, not about the living or dying. How do you get out of the labyrinth of suffering?" "What's wrong?" I asked, and I felt the absence of her hand on me. "Nothing's wrong. But there's always suffering, Pudge. Homework, or malaria,
or having a boyfriend who lives far away when there's a good-looking boy lying next to you. Suffering is universal. It's the one thing Buddhists, Christians, and Muslims are all worried about. I turned to her. Oh, so maybe Dr. Hyde's class isn't total bullshit. And both of us lying on our sides, she smiled, our noses almost touching, my unblinking eyes on hers, her face blushing from the wine, and I opened my mouth again, but this time not to speak. And she reached up and put a finger to my lips and said, "Shh, shh, don't ruin it." 51 days before. The next morning, I didn't hear the knocking, if there was any. I just heard, "Up, do you know what time it is?" I looked at the clock and groggily muttered, "It's 7:36. "No, Pudge, it's party time. We've only got 7 days left before everyone comes back. Oh, God, I can't even tell you how nice it is to have you here. Last Thanksgiving, I spent the whole time constructing one massive candle using the wax from all my little candles. God, it was boring. Accounting the ceiling tiles. 67 down, 84 across. Talk about suffering. Absolute torture. I'm really tired. I said, and then she cut me off. "Poor Pudge. Oh, poor, poor Pudge. Do you want me to climb into bed with you and cuddle?" "Well, if you're offering..." "No! Up! Now!" She took me behind a wing of weekday warrior rooms, 50 to 59, and stopped in front of a window, placed her palms flat against it, and pushed up until the window was half open, then crawled inside. I followed. "What do you see, Pudge?" I saw a dorm room, the same cinder block walls, the same dimensions, even the same layout as my own. Their couch was nicer, and they had an actual coffee table, instead of a trunk labeled coffee table. They had two posters on the wall. One featured a huge stack of $100 bills with the caption, "The first million is the hardest." On the opposite wall, a poster of a red Ferrari. I see a dorm room.
"You're not looking, Pudge. When I go into your room, I see a couple of guys who love video games. When I look at my room, I see a girl who loves books."
She walked over to the couch and picked up a plastic soda bottle.
"Look at this," she said, and I saw that it was half filled with a brackish brown liquid. Dip spit. "So they dip, and they obviously aren't hygienic about it. So are they going to care if we pee on their toothbrushes? They won't care enough, that's for sure. Look, tell me what these guys love."
"They love money," I said, pointing to the poster. She threw up her hands, exasperated.
"They all love money, Pudge. Okay, go into the bathroom. Tell me what you see there."
The game was annoying me a little, but I went into the bathroom as she sat down on that inviting couch. Inside the shower, I found a dozen bottles of shampoo and conditioner. In the medicine cabinet, I found a cylindrical bottle of something called Rewind. I opened it. The bluish gel smelled like flowers and rubbing alcohol, like a fancy hair salon. Under the sink, I also found a tub of Vaseline so big that it could have only one possible use, which I didn't care to dwell on. I came back into the room and excitedly said, "They love their hair."
"Precisely," she shouted. "Look on the top bunk."
Perilously positioned on the thin wooden headboard of the bed, a bottle of Stay Wet gel.
"Kevin doesn't just wake up with that spiky bedhead look, Pudge. He works for it. He loves that hair. They leave their hair products here, Pudge, because they have duplicates at home. All those boys do, and do you know why?"
"Because they're compensating for their tiny little penises?" I asked.
"Ha ha, no. That's why they're macho assholes. They love their hair because they aren't smart enough to love something more interesting. So we hit them where it hurts. The scalp."
"Okay," I said, unsure of how exactly to prank someone's scalp. She stood up and walked to the window and bent over to shimmy out.
"Don't look at my ass," she said,
and so I looked at her ass, spreading out wide from her thin waist. She effortlessly somersaulted out the half-opened window. I took the feet-first approach, and once I got my feet on the ground, I limboed my upper body out the window.
"Well," she said, "that looked awkward. Let's go to the smoking hole."
She shuffled her feet to kick up dry orange dirt on the road to the bridge,
seeming not to walk so much as cross-country ski. As we followed the almost trail down from the bridge to the hole, she turned around and looked back at me, stopping. "I wonder how one would go about acquiring industrial-strength blue dye," she said, and then held a tree branch back for me. 49 days before. 2 days later, Monday, the first real day of vacation, I spent the morning working on my religion final and went to Alaska's room in the afternoon. She was reading in bed. "Auden," she announced. "What were his last words?"
"Don't know. Never heard of him."
"Never heard of him? You poor illiterate boy. Here, read this line."
I walked over and looked down at her index finger. "You shall love your crooked neighbor with your crooked heart," I read aloud.
"Yeah, that's pretty good," I said.
"Pretty good? Sure, and bufritos are pretty good. Sex is pretty fun. The sun is pretty hot. Jesus, it says so much about love and brokenness. It's perfect."
"Mm-hmm," I nodded unenthusiastically.
"You're hopeless. Want to go porn hunting?"
"Huh?"
"We can't love our neighbors till we know how crooked their hearts are. Don't you like porn?" she asked, smiling.
I answered. The truth was that I hadn't seen much porn, but the idea of looking at porn with Alaska had a certain appeal. We started with the 50s wing of dorms and made our way backward around the hexagon. She pushed open the back windows while I looked out and made sure no one was walking by. I'd never been in most people's rooms. After 3 months, I knew most people, but I regularly talked to very few, just the colonel and Alaska and Takumi, really. But in a few hours, I got to know my classmates quite well. Wilson Carbot, the center for the Culver Creek Nothings, had hemorrhoids, or at least he kept hemorrhoidal cream secreted away in the bottom drawer of his desk. Chandra Kylers, a cute girl who loved math a little too much and who Alaska believed was the colonel's future girlfriend, collected Cabbage Patch Kids. I don't mean that she collected Cabbage Patch Kids when she was like 5. She collected them now. Dozens of them. Black, white, Latino, and Asian, boys and girls, babies dressed like farmhands and budding businessmen. A senior weekday warrior named Holly Moser sketched nude self-portraits in charcoal pencil, portraying her rotund form in all its girth. I was stunned by how many people had booze. Even the weekday warriors, who got to go home every weekend, had beer and liquor stashed everywhere from toilet tanks to the bottoms of dirty clothes hampers.
"God, I could have ratted out anyone," Alaska said softly as she unearthed a 40-ounce bottle of Magnum malt liquor from Longwell Chase's closet.
I wondered then why she had chosen Paul and Mariah. Alaska found everyone's secrets so fast that I suspected she'd done this before. But she couldn't possibly have had advanced knowledge of the secrets of Ruth and Margot Blauker, ninth-grade twin sisters who were new and seemed to socialize even less than I did. After crawling into their room, Alaska looked around for a moment, then walked to the bookshelf. She stared at it, then pulled out the King James Bible, and there, a purple bottle of Maui Wowie wine cooler.
"How clever," she said as she twisted off the cap.
She drank it down in 2 long sips and then proclaimed, "Maui Wowie!"
"They'll know you were here," I shouted.
Her eyes widened.
"Oh, no. You're right, Pudge," she said. "Maybe they'll go to the Eagle and tell him that someone stole their wine cooler."
She laughed and leaned out the window, throwing the empty bottle onto the grass. And we found plenty of porn magazines haphazardly stuffed in between mattresses and box springs. It turns out that Hank Walston did like something other than basketball and pot. He liked jugs. But we didn't find a movie until room 32, occupied by a couple of guys from Mississippi named Joe and Marcus. They were in our religion class and sometimes sat with the colonel and me at lunch, but I didn't know them well. Alaska read the sticker on the top of the video. "The bitches of Madison County. Well, ain't that just delightful?" We ran with it to the TV room, closed the blinds, locked the door, and watched the movie. It opened with a woman standing on a bridge with her legs spread, while a guy knelt in front of her, giving her oral sex.
No time for dialogue, I suppose. By the time they started doing it, Alaska commenced with her righteous indignation.
They just don't make sex look fun for women. The girl is just an object. Look, look at that.
I was already looking, needless to say. A woman crouched on her hands and knees while a guy knelt behind her. She kept saying, "Give it to me," and moaning, and though her eyes, brown and blank, betrayed her lack of interest, I couldn't help but take mental notes.
Hands on her shoulders, I noted. Fast, but not too fast, or it's going to be over fast. Keep your grunting to a minimum.
As if reading my mind, she said,
"God, Pudge, never do it that hard. That would hurt. That looks like torture. And all she can do is just sit there and take it? This is not a man and a woman. It's a penis and a vagina. What's erotic about that? Where's the kissing?"
"Given their position, I don't think they can kiss right now," I noted.
"That's my point. Just by virtue of how they're doing it, it's objectification. He can't even see her face. This is what can happen to women, Pudge. That woman is someone's daughter. This is what you make us do for money."
"Well, not me," I said defensively. "I mean, not technically. I don't, like, produce porn movies."
"Look me in the eye and tell me this doesn't turn you on, Pudge."
I couldn't. She laughed. "It was fine," she said. "Healthy." And then she got up, stopped the tape, lay down on her stomach across the couch, and mumbled something. "What did you say?" I asked, walking to her, putting my hand on the small of her back.
"Shh," she said. "I'm sleeping."
Just like that. From 100 miles an hour to asleep in a nanosecond. I wanted so badly to lie down next to her on the couch, to wrap my arms around her and sleep. Not fuck, like in those movies, not even have sex, just sleep together, in the most innocent sense of the phrase. But I lacked the courage, and she had a boyfriend, and I was gawky, and she was gorgeous, and I was hopelessly boring, and she was endlessly fascinating. So I walked back to my room and collapsed on the bottom bunk, thinking that if people were rain, I was drizzle, and she was a hurricane. 47 days before. On Wednesday morning, I woke up with a stuffy nose to an entirely new Alabama, a crisp and cold one. As I walked to Alaska's room that morning, the frosty grass of the dorm circle crunched beneath my shoes. You don't run into frost much in Florida, and I jumped up and down like I was stomping on bubble wrap. Crunch, crunch, crunch. Alaska was holding a burning green candle in her hand upside down, dripping the wax onto a larger homemade candle that looked a bit like a Technicolor middle school science project volcano. "Don't burn yourself," I said as the flame crept up toward her hand.
"Night falls fast. Today is in the past," she said without looking up.
"Wait, I've read that before. What is that?" I asked.
With her free hand, she grabbed a book and tossed it toward me. It landed at my feet. "Poem," she said, "Edna St. Vincent Millay."
"You've read that? I'm stunned."
"Oh, I read her biography. Didn't have her last words in it, though. I was a little bitter. All I remember is that she had a lot of sex."
"I know, she's my hero," Alaska said, without a trace of irony. I laughed, but she didn't notice.
"Does it seem at all odd to you that you enjoy biographies of great writers a lot more than you enjoy their actual writing?"
"Nope," I announced. "Just because they were interesting people doesn't mean I care to hear their musings on nighttime."
"It's about depression, dumbass." "Ooh, really? Well, geez, then it's brilliant," I answered.
She sighed. "All right. The snow may be falling in the winter of my discontent, but at least I've got sarcastic company. Sit down, will you?" I sat down next to her with my legs crossed and our knees touching. She pulled a clear plastic crate filled with dozens of candles out from underneath her bed. She looked at it for a moment, then handed me a white one and a lighter. We spent all morning burning candles. Well, and occasionally lighting cigarettes off the burning candles, after we stuffed a towel into the crack at the bottom of her door. Over the course of 2 hours, we added a full foot to the summit of her polychrome candle volcano.
"Mount St. Helens on acid," she said.
At 12:30, after 2 hours of me begging for a ride to McDonald's, Alaska decided it was time for lunch. As we began to walk to the student parking lot, I saw a strange car, a small green car, a hatchback. "I've seen that car," I thought.
where have I seen the car?
And then the colonel jumped out and ran to meet us. Rather than like, I don't know, hello or something, the colonel began, I have been instructed to invite you to Thanksgiving dinner at Chez Martin.
Alaska whispered into my ear, and then I laughed and said, I have been instructed to accept your invitation.
So we walked over to the Eagle's house, told him we were going to eat turkey trailer park style, and sped away in a hatchback. The colonel explained it to us on the 2-hour car ride south. I was crammed into the back seat because Alaska had called shotgun. She usually drove, but when she didn't, she was shotgun-calling queen of the world. The colonel's mother heard that we were on campus and couldn't bear the thought of leaving us familyless for Thanksgiving. The colonel didn't seem too keen on the whole idea.
I'm going to have to sleep in a tent, he said, and I laughed.
Except it turns out he did have to sleep in a tent. A nice 4-person green outfit, shaped like half an egg, but still a tent. The colonel's mom lived in a trailer, as in the kind of thing you might see attached to a large pickup truck. Except this particular one was old and falling apart on its cinder blocks, and probably couldn't have been hooked up to a truck without disintegrating. It wasn't even a particularly big trailer. I could just barely stand up to my full height without scraping the ceiling. Now I understood why the colonel was short. He couldn't afford to be any taller. The place was really one long room with a full-size bed in the front, a kitchenette, and a living area in the back with a TV and a small bathroom, so small that in order to take a shower, you pretty much had to sit on the toilet. It ain't much, the colonel's mom, that's Dolores, not Miss Martin, told us. But y'all's going to have a turkey the size of the kitchen. She laughed. The colonel ushered us out of the trailer immediately after our brief tour, and we walked through the neighborhood, a series of trailers and mobile homes on dirt roads.
Well, now you get why I hate rich people.
And I did. I couldn't fathom how the colonel grew up in such a small place. The entire trailer was smaller than our dorm room. I didn't know what to say to him, how to make him feel less embarrassed.
I'm sorry if it makes you uncomfortable, he said. I know it's probably foreign.
Not to me, Alaska piped up.
Well, you don't live in a trailer, he told her.
Poor is poor.
I suppose, the colonel said.
Alaska decided to go help Dolores with dinner. She said that it was sexist to leave the cooking to the women, but better to have good sexist food than crappy boy-prepared food. So the colonel and I sat on the pull-out couch in the living room, playing video games and talking about school.
I finished my religion paper, but I have to type it up on your computer when we get back. I think I'm ready for finals, which is good, since we have an Ankh pray to Ann play.
Your mom doesn't know Pig Latin? I smirked.
Not if I talk fast. Christ, be quiet.
The food, fried okra, steamed corn on the cob, and pot roast that was so tender it fell right off the plastic fork, convinced me that Dolores was an even better cook than Maureen. Culver Creek's okra had more grease, less crunch. Dolores was also the funniest mom I'd ever met. When Alaska asked her what she did for work, she smiled and said, I'm a culinary engineer. That's a short order cook at the Waffle House to y'all.
Best Waffle House in Alabama.
The colonel smiled, and then I realized he wasn't embarrassed by his mom at all. He was just scared that we would act like condescending boarding school snobs. I'd always found the colonel's I hate the rich routine a little overwrought until I saw him with his mom. He was the same colonel, but in a totally different context. It made me hope that one day I could meet Alaska's family, too. Dolores insisted that Alaska and I share the bed, and she slept on the pullout while the colonel was out in his tent. I worried he would get cold, but frankly, I wasn't about to give up my bed with Alaska. We had separate blankets, and there were never fewer than 3 layers between us, but the possibilities kept me up half the night. 46 days before. Best Thanksgiving food I'd ever had. No crappy cranberry sauce, just huge slabs of moist white meat, corn, green beans cooked in enough bacon fat to make them taste like they weren't good for you, biscuits with gravy, pumpkin pie for dessert, and a glass of red wine for each of us. I believe, Dolores said, that you're supposed to drink white with turkey, but now, I don't know about y'all, but I don't suppose I give a shit. We laughed and drank our wine, and then after the meal, we each listed our gratitudes. My family always did that before the meal, and we all just rushed through it to get to the food. So the four of us sat around the table and shared our blessings. I was thankful for the fine food and the fine company, for having a home on Thanksgiving. "A trailer, at least," Dolores joked.
"Okay, my turn," Alaska said. "I'm grateful for having just had my best Thanksgiving in a decade."
Then the colonel said, "I'm just grateful for you, Mom." And Dolores laughed and said, "That dog won't hunt, boy."
I didn't exactly know what that phrase meant, but it apparently meant that was inadequate, because then the colonel expanded his list to acknowledge that he was grateful to be
the smartest human being in this trailer park. And Dolores laughed and said,
"Good enough."
And Dolores? She was grateful that her phone was back on, that her boy was home, that Alaska helped her cook, and that I had kept the colonel out of her hair, that her job was steady and her co-workers were nice, that she had a place to sleep and a boy who loved her. I sat in the back of the hatchback on the drive home, and that is how I thought of it, home, and fell asleep to the highway's monotonous lullaby. 44 days before.
Coosa Liquor's entire business model is built around selling cigarettes to minors and alcohol to adults.
Alaska looked at me with disconcerting frequency when she drove, particularly since we were winding through a narrow, hilly highway south of school, headed to the aforementioned Coosa Liquor's. It was Saturday, our last day of real vacation.
"Which is great if all you need is cigarettes, but we need booze, and they card for booze, and my ID blows, but I'll flirt my way through."
She made a sudden and unsignaled left turn, pulling onto a road that dropped precipitously down a hill, with fields on either side, and she gripped the steering wheel tight as we accelerated, and she waited until the last possible moment to brake, just before we reached the bottom of the hill. There stood a plywood gas station that no longer sold gas, with a faded sign bolted to the roof. "Coosa Liquors, we cater to your spiritual needs." Alaska went in alone and walked out the door 5 minutes later, weighed down by two paper bags filled with contraband. 3 cartons of cigarettes, 5 bottles of wine, and a fifth of vodka for the colonel. On the way home, Alaska said,
"You like knock-knock jokes?"
"Knock-knock jokes?" I asked.
"You mean like knock-knock?"
"Who's there?" replied Alaska.
"Who?"
"Hoo-hoo."
"What are you, an owl?"
I finished.
"Lame."
"That was brilliant," said Alaska.
"I have one. You start."
"Okay. Knock, knock.
Who's there?"
said Alaska. I looked at her blankly.
About a minute later, I got it and laughed.
My mom told me that joke when I was 6. It's still funny. So I could not have been more surprised when she showed up sobbing at room 43, just as I was putting the finishing touches on my final paper for English. She sat down on the couch, her every exhalation a mix of whimper and scream.
"I'm sorry,"
she said, heaving. Snot was dribbling down her chin.
"What's wrong?"
I asked. She picked up a Kleenex from the coffee table and wiped at her face.
"I don't,"
she started, and then a sob came like a tsunami, her cry so loud and childlike that it scared me, and I got up, sat down next to her, and put my arm around her. She turned away, pushing her head into the foam of the couch.
"I don't understand why I screw everything up," she said.
"What? Like with Mariah? Maybe you were just scared."
"Scared isn't a good excuse,"
she shouted into the couch.
"Scared is the excuse everyone has always used."
I didn't know who everyone was or when always was. And as much as I wanted to understand her ambiguities, the slyness was growing annoying.
"Why are you upset about this now?" "It's not just that, it's everything. But I told the colonel in the car."
She sniffled, but seemed done with the sobs.
"While you were sleeping in the back, and he said he'd never let me out of his sight during pranks, that he couldn't trust me on my own. And I don't blame him. I don't even trust me."
"It took guts to tell him," I said.
"I have guts, just not when it counts. Will you,
And she sat up straight, and then moved toward me, and I raised my arm as she collapsed into my skinny chest and cried. I felt bad for her, but she'd done it to herself.
She didn't have to rat.
I don't want to upset you, but maybe you just need to tell us all why you told on Mariah. Were you scared of going home or something?
She pulled away from me and gave me a look of doom that would have made the eagle proud, and I felt like she hated me or my question or both, and then she looked away, out the window, toward the soccer field, and said, "There's no home."
"Well, you have a family," I backpedaled. She'd talked to me about her mom just that morning. How could the girl who told that joke 3 hours before become a sobbing mess?
Still staring at me, she said,
"I try not to be scared, you know, but I still ruin everything. I still fuck up."
"Okay," I told her. "It's okay." I didn't even know what she was talking about anymore. One vague notion after another.
"Don't you know who you love, Pudge? You love the girl who makes you laugh and shows you porn and drinks wine with you. You don't love the crazy, sullen bitch."
And there was something to that, truth be told. Christmas. We all went home for Christmas break, even purportedly homeless Alaska. I got a nice watch and a new wallet, grown-up gifts, my dad called them. But mostly I just studied for those 2 weeks. Christmas vacation wasn't really a vacation, on account of how it was our last chance to study for exams, which started the day after we got back. I focused on pre-calc and biology, the two classes that most deeply threatened my goal of a 3.4 GPA. I wish I could say I was in it for the thrill of learning, but mostly I was in it for the thrill of getting into a worthwhile college. So, yeah, I spent a lot of my time at home studying math and memorizing French vocab, just like I had before Culver Creek. Really, being at home for 2 weeks was just like my entire life before Culver Creek, except my parents were more emotional. They talked very little about their trip to London. I think they felt guilty. That's a funny thing about parents. Even though I pretty much stayed at the creek over Thanksgiving because I wanted to, my parents still felt guilty. It's nice to have people who will feel guilty for you, although I could have lived without my mom crying during every single family dinner. She would say, "I'm a bad mother." And my dad and I would immediately reply, "No, you're not." Even my dad, who is affectionate but not, like, sentimental, randomly, while we were watching The Simpsons, said he missed me. I said I missed him, too, and I did, sort of. They're such nice people. We went to the movies and played card games, and I told them the stories I could tell them without horrifying them, and they listened. My dad, who sold real estate for a living but read more books than anyone I knew, talked with me about the books I was reading for English class, and my mom insisted that I sit with her in the kitchen and learn how to make simple dishes, macaroni, scrambled eggs, now that I was living on my own. Never mind that I didn't have or want a kitchen. Never mind that I didn't like eggs or macaroni and cheese. By New Year's Day, I could make them anyway. When I left, they both cried, my mom explaining that it was just empty nest syndrome, that they were just so proud of me, that they loved me so much. That put a lump in my throat, and I didn't care about Thanksgiving anymore. I had a family. 8 days before. Alaska walked in on the first day back from Christmas break and sat beside the colonel on the couch. The colonel was hard at work breaking a land speed record on the PlayStation. She didn't say she missed us or that she was glad to see us. She just looked at the couch and said, "You really need a new couch."
"Please don't address me when I'm racing," the colonel said. "God, does Jeff Gordon have to put up with this shit?"
"I've got an idea," she said. "It's great. What we need is a pre-prank that coincides with an attack on Kevin and his minions," she said.
I was sitting on the bed reading the textbook in preparation for my American history exam the next day.
"A pre-prank?" I asked.
"A prank designed to lull the administration into a false sense of security," the colonel answered, annoyed by the distraction. "After the pre-prank, the eagle will think the junior class has done its prank and won't be waiting for it when it actually comes."
Every year, the junior and senior classes pulled off a prank at some point in the year, usually something lame like Roman candles in the dorm circle at 5 in the morning on a Sunday. Is there always a pre-prank? I asked.
No, you idiot, the colonel said. If there was always a pre-prank, then the eagle would expect two pranks. The last time a pre-prank was used, 1987, when the pre-prank was cutting off electricity to campus, and then the actual prank was putting 500 live crickets in the heating ducts of the classrooms. Sometimes you can still hear the chirping.
Your rote memorization is, like, so impressive, I said. You guys are like an old married couple. Alaska smiled, in a creepy way.
You don't know the half of it, the colonel said. You should see this kid try to crawl into bed with me at night.
Hey, let's get on subject, Alaska said. Pre-prank. This weekend, since there's a new moon. We're staying at the barn. You, me, the colonel, Takumi, and, as a special gift to you, Pudge, Lara Buterskaya. The Lara Buterskaya I puked on? She's just shy. She still likes you. Alaska laughed. Puking made you look vulnerable.
Very perky boobs, the colonel said. Are you bringing Takumi for me?
You need to be single for a while.
True enough, the colonel said.
Just spend a few more months playing video games, she said. That hand-eye coordination will come in handy when you get to third base.
Gosh. I haven't heard the base system in so long I think I've forgotten third base, the colonel responded. I would roll my eyes at you, but I can't afford to look away from the screen.
French, feel, finger, fuck. It's like you skipped third grade, Alaska said.
I did skip third grade, the colonel answered.
So, I said, what's our pre-prank? The colonel and I will work that out. No need to get you into trouble. Yet.
Oh. Okay. I'm gonna go for a cigarette, then.
I left. It wasn't the first time Alaska had left me out of the loop, certainly, but after we'd been together so much over Thanksgiving, it seemed ridiculous to plan the prank with the colonel but without me. Whose T-shirts were wet with her tears? Mine. Who'd listened to her read Vonnegut? Me. Who'd been the butt of the world's worst knock-knock joke? Me. I walked to the sunny convenience kiosk across from school and smoked. This never happened to me in Florida, this oh-so-high school angst about who likes whom more, and I hated myself for letting it happen now. You don't have to care about her, I told myself. Screw her.
4 days before. The colonel wouldn't tell me a word about the pre-prank, except that it was to be called Barn Night, and that when I packed, I should pack for 2 days. Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday were torture. The colonel was always with Alaska, and I was never invited. So I spent an inordinate amount of time studying for finals, which helped my GPA considerably, and I finally finished my religion paper. My answer to the question was straightforward enough, really. Most Christians and Muslims believe in a heaven and a hell, though there's a lot of disagreement within both religions over what exactly will get you into one afterlife or the other. Buddhists are more complicated because of the Buddha's doctrine of anatta, which basically says that people don't have eternal souls. Instead, they have a bundle of energy, and that bundle of energy is transitory, migrating from one body to another, reincarnating endlessly until it eventually reaches enlightenment. I never liked writing concluding paragraphs to papers, where you just repeat what you've already said with phrases like, in summation, and to conclude. I didn't do that. Instead, I talked about why I thought it was an important question. People, I thought, wanted security. They couldn't bear the idea of death being a big black nothing, couldn't bear the thought of their loved ones not existing, and couldn't even imagine themselves not existing. I finally decided that people believed in an afterlife because they couldn't bear not to.
3 days before. On Friday, after a surprisingly successful pre-calc exam that brought my first set of Culver Creek finals to a close, I packed clothes. Think New York trendy, the colonel advised. Think black. Think sensible, comfortable, but warm. And my sleeping bag into a backpack, and we picked up Takumi in his room and walked to the Eagle's house. The Eagle was wearing his only outfit, and I wondered whether he just had 30 identical white button-down shirts and 30 identical black ties in his closet. I pictured him waking up in the morning, staring at his closet, and thinking, how about a white shirt and a black tie? Talk about a guy who could use a wife. I'm taking Miles and Takumi home for the weekend to New Hope, the colonel told him.
Miles liked his taste of New Hope that much? The eagle asked me.
Yee-haw! There's gonna be a hoedown at the trailer park, the colonel said.
He could actually have a southern accent when he wanted to, although, like most everyone at Culver Creek, he didn't usually speak with one.
Hold on a moment while I call your mom, the eagle said to the colonel.
Takumi looked at me with poorly disguised panic, and I felt lunch, fried chicken, rising in my stomach. But the colonel just smiled.
Sure thing.
Chip and Miles and Takumi will be at your house this weekend?
Yes, ma'am.
Ha! Okay. Bye now.
The eagle looked up at the colonel.
Your mom is a wonderful woman.
The eagle smiled.
You're telling me.
The colonel grinned.
See you on Sunday.
As we walked toward the gym parking lot, the colonel said,
I called her yesterday and asked her to cover for me, and she didn't even ask why.
She just said,
I sure trust you, son.
And hot damn she does.
Once out of sight of the eagle's house, we took a sharp right into the woods. We walked on the dirt road over the bridge and back to the school's barn, a dilapidated, leak-prone structure that looked more like a long-abandoned log cabin than a barn. They still stored hay there, although I don't know what for. It wasn't like we had an equestrian program or anything. The colonel, Takumi, and I got there first, setting up our sleeping bags on the softest bales of hay. It was 6:30. Alaska came shortly after, having told the eagle she was spending the weekend with Jake. The eagle didn't check that story, because Alaska spent at least one weekend there every month, and he knew that her parents never cared. Lara showed up half an hour later. She'd told the eagle that she was driving to Atlanta to see an old friend from Romania. The eagle called Lara's parents to make sure that they knew she was spending a weekend off campus, and they didn't mind.
They trust me, she smiled.
You don't sound like you have an accent sometimes, I said, which was pretty stupid, but a darn sight better than throwing up on her.
It's only soft eyes.
No soft eyes in Russian? I asked.
Romanian, she corrected me.
Turns out Romanian is a language. Who knew? My cultural sensitivity quotient was going to have to drastically increase if I was going to share a sleeping bag with Lara anytime soon. Everybody was sitting on sleeping bags, Alaska smoking with flagrant disregard for the overwhelming flammability of the structure, when the colonel pulled out a single piece of computer paper and read from it.
The point of this evening's festivities is to prove once and for all that we are to pranking what the weekday warriors are to sucking. But we'll also have the opportunity to make life unpleasant for the eagle, which is always a welcome pleasure. And so, he said, pausing as if for a drum roll, we fight tonight a battle on three fronts. Front one, the pre-prank. We will, as it were, light a fire under the eagle's ass.
Front two, Operation Baldy, wherein Lara flies solo in a retaliatory mission so elegant and cruel that it could only have been the brainchild of, well, me.
Hey, Alaska interrupted. It was my idea.
Okay, fine. It was Alaska's idea. He laughed. And finally, front three, the progress reports. We're going to hack into the faculty computer network and use their grading database to send out letters to Kevin et al.'s families saying that they are failing some of their classes.
We are definitely going to get expelled, I said.
I hope you didn't bring the Asian kid along thinking he's a computer genius, because I am not, Takumi said.
We're not going to get expelled, and I'm the computer genius. The rest of you are muscle and distraction. We won't get expelled even if we get caught, because there are no expellable offenses here. Well, except for the 5 bottles of Strawberry Hill in Alaska's backpack, and that will be well hidden. We're just, you know, wreaking a little havoc.
The plan was laid out, and it left no room for error. The colonel relied so heavily on perfect synchronicity that if one of us messed up, even slightly, the endeavor would collapse entirely. He had printed up individual itineraries for each of us, including times exact to the second. Our watches synchronized, our clothes black, our backpacks on, our breath visible in the cold, our minds filled with the minute details of the plan, our hearts racing. We walked out of the barn together, once it was completely dark, around 7. The 5 of us walking confidently in a row, I'd never felt cooler. The great perhaps was upon us, and we were invincible. The plan may have had faults, but we did not. After 5 minutes, we split up to go to our destinations. I stuck with Takumi. We were the distraction.
"We're the fucking Marines," he said.
"First to fight, first to die," I agreed nervously.
"Hell yes."
He stopped and opened his bag.
"Not here, dude," I said. "We have to go to the Eagles."
I know. Just hold on."
He pulled out a thick headband. It was brown with a plush fox head on the front. He put it on his head. I laughed. "What the hell is that?"
"It's my fox hat."
"Your fox hat?"
"Yeah, Pudge, my fox hat."
"Why are you wearing your fox hat?" I asked.
"Because no one can catch the motherfucking fox."
2 minutes later, we were crouching behind the trees 50 feet from the Eagle's back door. My heart thumped like a techno drumbeat.
30 seconds,
Takumi whispered, and I felt the same spooked nervousness that I'd felt that first night with Alaska when she grabbed my hand and whispered, "Run, run, 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 run," but I stayed put. I thought, "We are not close enough." I thought, "He will not hear it." I thought, "He will hear it and be out so fast that we will have no chance." I thought, 20 seconds. I was breathing hard and fast.
"Hey, Pudge," Takumi whispered, "you can do this, dude. It's just running."
"Right. Just running. My knees are good. My lungs are fair. It's just running."
5, he said. 4, 3, 2, 1. "Light it. Light it, light it."
It lit with a sizzle that reminded me of every July 4th with my family. We stood still for a nanosecond, staring at the fuse, making sure it was lit. "And now," I thought, "now. Run, 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 run." But my body didn't move until I heard Takumi shout whisper,
"Go, go, go, fucking go!"
And we went. 3 seconds later, a huge burst of pops. It sounded to me like the automatic gunfire in Decapitation, except louder. We were 20 steps away already, and I thought my eardrums would burst. I thought, "Well, he will certainly hear it." We ran past the soccer field and into the woods, running uphill and with only the vaguest sense of direction. In the dark, fallen branches and moss-covered rocks appeared at the last possible second, and I slipped and fell repeatedly and worried that the Eagle would catch up, but I just kept getting up and running beside Takumi, away from the classrooms and the dorm circle. We ran like we had golden shoes. I ran like a cheetah. Well, like a cheetah that smoked too much. And then, after precisely 1 minute of running, Takumi stopped and ripped open his backpack. My turn to count down. Staring at my watch, terrified. By now, he was surely out. He was surely running. I wondered if he was fast. He was old, but he'd be mad. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And the sizzle. We didn't pause that time, just ran, still west. Breath heaving. I wondered if I could do this for 30 minutes. The firecrackers exploded. The pops ended, and a voice cried out, "Stop right now!" But we did not stop. Stopping was not in the plan.
"I'm the motherfucking fox," Takumi whispered, both to himself and to me. "No one can catch the fox."
A minute later, I was on the ground. Takumi counted down. The fuse lit. We ran. But it was a dud. We had prepared for one dud, bringing an extra string of firecrackers. Another, though, would cost the colonel and Alaska a minute. Takumi crouched down on the ground, lit the fuse, and ran. The popping started. The fireworks bang, bang, banged in sync with my heartbeat. When the firecrackers finished, I heard, "Stop or I'll call the police!" And though the voice was distant, I could feel his look of doom bearing down on me.
"The pigs can't stop the fox. I'm too quick," Takumi said to himself. I can rhyme while I run. I'm that slick.
The colonel warned us about the police threat. Told us not to worry. The Eagle didn't like to bring the police to campus. Bad publicity. So we ran. Over and under and through all manner of trees and bushes and branches. We fell, we got up, we ran. If he couldn't follow us with the firecrackers, he could sure as hell follow the sound of our whispered shits as we tripped over dead logs and fell into briar bushes. 1 minute, I knelt down, lit the fuse, ran. Bang! Then we turned north, thinking we'd gotten past the lake. This was key to the plan. The farther we got while still staying on campus, the farther the Eagle would follow us. The farther he followed us, the farther he would be from the classrooms, where the Colonel and Alaska were working their magic. And then we planned to loop back near the classrooms and swing east along the creek until we came to the bridge over our smoking hole, where we would rejoin the road and walk back to the barn triumphant. But here's the thing. We made a slight error in navigation. We weren't past the lake. Instead, we were staring at a field and then the lake. Too close to the classrooms to run anywhere but along the lakefront, I looked over at Takumi, who was running with me stride for stride, and he just said, "Drop one now." So I dropped down, lit the fuse, and we ran. We were running through a clearing now, and if the Eagle was behind us, he could see us. We got to the south corner of the lake and started running along the shore. The lake wasn't all that big, maybe a quarter mile long, so we didn't have far to go when I saw it. The swan. Swimming toward us like a swan possessed, wings flapping furiously as it came, and then it was on the shore in front of us, making a noise that sounded like nothing else in this world, like all the worst parts of a dying rabbit, plus all the worst parts of a crying baby, and there was no other way, so we just ran. I hit the swan at a full run and felt it bite into my ass, and then I was running with a noticeable limp because my ass was on fire, and I thought to myself, what the hell is in swan saliva that burns so badly? The 23rd string was a dud, costing us 1 minute. At that point, I wanted a minute. I was dying. The burning sensation in my left buttock had dulled to an intense aching, magnified each time I landed on my left leg, so I was running like an injured gazelle trying to evade a pride of lions. Our speed, needless to say, had slowed considerably. We hadn't heard the Eagle since we got across the lake, but I didn't think he had turned around. He was trying to lull us into complacency, but it would not work. Tonight, we were invincible. Exhausted, we stopped with 3 strings left and hoped we'd given the colonel enough time. We ran for a few more minutes until we found the bank of the creek. It was so dark and so still that the tiny stream of water seemed to roar, but I could still hear our hard, fast breaths as we collapsed on wet clay and pebbles beside the creek. Only when we stopped did I look at Takumi. His face and arms were scratched, the fox head now directly over his left ear. Looking at my own arms, I noticed blood dripping from the deeper cuts. There were, I remembered now, some wicked briar patches, but I was feeling no pain. Takumi picked thorns out of his leg. "The fox is fucking tired," he said, and laughed. "The swan bit my ass," I told him. "I saw," he smiled. "Is it bleeding?" I reached my hand into my pants to check. No blood, so I smoked to celebrate. "Mission accomplished," I said. "Pudge, my friend, we are indefuckinstructible." We couldn't figure out where we were because the creek doubles back so many times through the campus, so we followed the creek for about 10 minutes, figuring we walked half as fast as we ran, and then turned left.
"Left, you think?" Takumi asked.
"I'm pretty lost," I said.
"The fox is pointing left, so left."
And sure enough, the fox took us right back to the barn.
"You're okay," Lara said as we walked up. "I was worried. I saw the Eagle run out of his house. He was wearing pajamas. He sure looked mad."
I said, "Well, if he was mad then, I wouldn't want to see him now."
"What took you so long?" she asked me.
"We took the long way home," Takumi said. "Plus, Pudge is walking like an old lady with hemorrhoids because the swan bit him on the ass. Where's Alaska and the colonel?"
"I don't know," Lara said, and then we heard footsteps in the distance, mutters and cracking branches. In a flash, Takumi grabbed our sleeping bags and backpacks and hid them behind bales of hay.
The 3 of us ran through the back of the barn and into the waist-high grass and lay down.
He tracked us back to the barn, I thought. We fucked everything up. But then I heard the colonel's voice, distinct and very annoyed, saying, "Because it narrows the list of possible suspects by 23. Why couldn't you just follow the plan? Christ, where is everybody?" We walked back to the barn, a bit sheepish from having overreacted. The colonel sat down on a bale of hay, his elbows on his knees, his head bowed, his palms against his forehead, thinking.
"Well, we haven't been caught yet, anyway. Okay, first," he said without looking up, "tell me everything else went all right. Lara?"
She started talking. "Yes, good."
"Can I have some more detail, please?"
"I did like your paper said. I stayed behind the Eagle's house until I saw him run after Miles and Takumi, and then I ran behind the dorms. And then I went through the window into Kevin's room. Then I put the stuff in the gel and the conditioner, and then I did the same thing in Jeff and Longwell's room."
"The stuff?" I asked.
"Undiluted industrial strength blue number 5 hair dye," Alaska said, "which I bought with your cigarette money. Apply it to wet hair, and it won't wash out for months." "We dyed their hair blue?"
"Well, technically," the colonel said, still speaking into his lap, "they're going to dye their own hair blue. But we have certainly made it easier for them. I know you and Takumi did all right, because we're here and you're here, so you did your job. And the good news is that the three assholes who had the gall to prank us have progress reports coming saying they are failing 3 classes."
"Uh-oh. What's the bad news?" Lara asked. "Oh, come on," Alaska said. "The other good news is that while the colonel was worried he'd heard something and ran into the woods, I saw to it that 20 other weekday warriors also have progress reports coming. I printed out reports for all of them, stuffed them into metered school envelopes, and then put them in the mailbox." She turned to the colonel. "You were sure gone a long time," she said. "The widow colonel, so scared of getting expelled." The colonel stood up, towering over the rest of us as we sat.
"That is not good news. That was not in the plan. That means there are 23 people who the Eagle can eliminate as suspects. 23 people who might figure out it was us and Rat."
"If that happens," Alaska said very seriously, "I'll take the fall."
"Right," the colonel sighed. "Like you took the fall for Paul and Mariah."
"You'll say that while you were traipsing through the woods lighting firecrackers, you were simultaneously hacking into the faculty network and printing out false progress reports on school stationery, because I'm sure that will fly with the Eagle."
"Relax, dude," Takumi said. "First off, we're not going to get caught. Second off, if we do, I'll take the fall with Alaska. You've got more to lose than any of us."
The colonel just nodded. It was an undeniable fact. The colonel would have no chance at a scholarship to a good school if he got expelled from the creek. Knowing that nothing cheered up the colonel like acknowledging his brilliance, I asked,
"So, how'd you hack the network?"
"I climbed in the window of Dr. Hyde's office, booted up his computer, and I typed in his password," he said, smiling.
"You guessed it?"
"No. On Tuesday, I went into his office and asked him to print me a copy of the recommended reading list, and then I watched him type the password. J3CKYLNHYD3.
"Well, shit," Takumi said. "I could have done that."
"Sure, but then you wouldn't have gotten to wear that sexy hat," the colonel said, laughing. Takumi took off the headband and put it in his bag.
"Kevin is going to be pissed about his hair," I said.
"Yeah, well, I'm really pissed about my waterlogged library. Kevin is a blow-up doll," Alaska said. "Prick us, we bleed. Prick him, he pops."
"It's true," said Takumi. "The guy's a dick. He kind of tried to kill you, after all."
"Yeah, I guess," I acknowledged.
"There are a lot of people here like that," Alaska went on, still fuming. "You know, fucking blow-up doll rich kids." But even though Kevin had sort of tried to kill me and all, he really didn't seem worth hating. Hating the cool kids takes an awful lot of energy, and I'd given up on it a long time ago. For me, the prank was just a response to a previous prank, just a golden opportunity to, as the colonel said, wreak a little havoc. But to Alaska, it seemed to be something else, something more.
I wanted to ask her about it, but she lay back down behind the piles of hay, invisible again. Alaska was done talking, and when she was done talking, that was it. We didn't coax her out for 2 hours until the colonel unscrewed a bottle of wine. We passed around the bottle till I could feel it in my stomach, sour and warm. I wanted to like booze more than I actually did, which is more or less the precise opposite of how I felt about Alaska. But that night, the booze felt great, as the warmth of the wine in my stomach spread through my body. I didn't like feeling stupid or out of control, but I liked the way it made everything, laughing, crying, peeing in front of your friends, easier. Why did we drink? For me, it was just fun, particularly since we were risking expulsion. The nice thing about the constant threat of expulsion at Culver Creek is that it lends excitement to every moment of illicit pleasure. The bad thing, of course, is that there is always the possibility of actual expulsion.
This is the end of disc number 3. Please continue listening on disc number 4.